I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. Photographic images are so ubiquitous now, you can take it for granted. The selfies and sunsets on social media, the images that accompany gripping news stories. Thanks to the boom in cameras on our phones and all the data we can store online now, we live in a culture of the image. We have a well-developed visual literacy in reading the images around us and curating the images we share. But what does it mean to be able to document the world around you immediately? Constantly even, to see yourself as others see you or manipulate the image you present to the world. And nearly 200 years after the first photograph, do filters and new AI tools mean we can no longer believe our own eyes? This time on The Butterfly Effect, the surprising reach of the camera.
I'm Todd Gustafson. I'm curator of the technology collection at the George Eastman House. We're the oldest photographic museum or museum dedicated specifically to photography in the world.
Todd's our guide to the history and evolution of the camera and film processing. But to do that, we need to first take a brief jump way, way back to the precursor of photography, the camera obscura.
Well, that's a drawing device that had probably been known since the beginning of time. I mean, if you happen to walk into forested trees, light that goes in between the leaves will actually project an image on the ground. So it had been around for a while.
Since antiquity, to be exact, camera obscura is Latin for dark chamber. Imagine standing inside a dark room. On one wall, there's a tiny hole with light coming through.
Sort of like the distances between the leaves on the trees, a little small circle.
On the opposite wall, projected in front of you, is the scene of what's happening in the world outside of the room you're standing in.
And then it was found that if you put some sort of optical lens in, the image would improve.
The pinhole camera. No need to go into a room. The tiny hole is now in a tiny box painted black inside and fitted with an angled mirror.
From then on, you have painters that were tracing the images and then trying to come up with some sort of a chemistry way of doing this. So it's in some ways really interesting how long it took to do this. On the other hand, if you get into the basic chemistry that they use, that actually set up the foundation for what would become film and George Eastman and all that sort of later.
The history of photography really kicks off in the 1820s with Joseph Nicéphore Niépce, the man credited with making the first permanent photograph.
So he tried to basically come up with a way of making prints they could put into books. They were doing some rather odd chemistry thing. Basically, he was using asphalt on a metal brass printing plate, and they were basically processing it with kind of like the modern equivalent of gasoline. At some point, a number of the scientific chemists realized by chance that certain salts of silver, when exposed to light, would turn dark. So they kind of knew how to make the chemistry happen, what they had trouble doing was actually making that image permanent, because it would just continue to darken. If you use modern terms, they needed a fixer.
Another key player in the history of the camera was Louis-Jacques Monde Daguerre.
Well, Niépce and Daguerre actually were partners. Unfortunately, Niépce passed away, and Daguerre sort of looked at some of these things that were going on. He decided, for some rather not exactly documented reasons, to take this copper printing plate and coat it with metallic silver on one side. The supposed story, and this is not, again, not documented, they found out, probably by mistake, that mercury vapor would actually make a direct positive image. Supposedly, he took a plate that had been exposed, again, probably for about a half hour in a camera obscura, put it in a drawer, and apparently a thermometer had been broken in the drawer. So they come up with this idea that mercury vapor would process the image. It's a little out there. So his process basically was that. You'd expose this copper printing plate that was coated with silver on one side for about a half hour or so, and then you could process it with mercury vapor. So the process was introduced to the public on August 1839, which is World Photography Day, and it's basically that. And of course, he received a pension from the French government, and he was supposed to improve the process. He never did. So what comes after this is actually ways of making the plates a little bit more light sensitive. They actually double sensitize them, silver and bromine, and then they use better, faster lenses. So eventually, by 1841, you could actually make portraits.
Who was able to get their hands on the early models of the camera, and what were they taking pictures of?
The cameras were available for sale, I believe, in September that same 1839 year, and it would have been fairly wealthy individuals. It was still life images. I mean, usually nothing moving, just whatever was outside that window. They're not exactly the sorts of photos that we think of today. First of all, it's on a metallic silver plate, and the image is actually on the surface, not in the film as we think of it today. So if you touch it, you'll actually wipe the image off. So they had to be they had to be framed and cased to be protected. So initially, again, you're talking about long exposures. It also had to be made between certain times of day when you're getting more UV light, because this particular material was sensitive to blue and UV light, ultraviolet light. So it's not until you get into, like I said, the double processed and faster lenses a few years later when you can do this. But they work best usually from about 10 in the morning till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We've had people make daguerreotype images here, and later in the day, the exposures become much, much longer as the UV light recedes as the sun moves closer to the horizon.
I am Amy Morrison, an associate professor of English at the University of Waterloo, and I fart around on the internet for a living. The early days of photography, right, we tend to think of the Victorians, right, who really made portraiture and photography a thing, as being remarkably unhappy, stiff people, right, because they have these rigid postures, and they're never smiling. Well, the reason for that is that the exposure times on the cameras were like up to a minute, right, to take a photo. So, I mean, you try to hold a dynamic pose picking up a loaf of bread off the floor that you drop while smiling for a minute, right? So there were actually these like kind of structures that they would place behind sitters that would like hold your head in place, right? So you could arrange yourself against basically a traction device that would hold you still. And I encourage everyone to try to smile for an entire minute without moving their face, and you will find that it's impossible. And that's why nobody is smiling either, right? So there's a little bit of ways in which the technique available at the time and the technology available at the time constrained what types of photos people could take and how they could take them. So there are very few candid shots, because you can't take a candid shot and make everything hold still for a minute. Mm-hmm. The cameras were large, right? So you wouldn't just sort of bring them out on a trip to the grocery store to go to the cheese section to look for the Emmental, right? You wouldn't bring it with you. It's a major ordeal, required darkness to prepare the plates. Shots were taken one at a time because it was not roll film at that point. Like, you just really couldn't take a bunch of pictures.
Right.
At the same time, the poses that people had were very stiff, but the settings often looked like they were drawn from oil paintings, right? Because they were. Because that was the representational mode that we had before, was family portraits done in paintings, right? So the middle-class people who were getting their portraits done in daguerreotypes in the early photography era were now able to access having family portraits. But now they were photographic portraits, but they were mimicking the setups and style of oil paintings. And it takes a long time to break that habit, actually.
When you talk about photography and cameras, you're really looking at the development of one consumer product over a 170 or so year time frame. And there's lots of moving parts, lots of elements that change. So you've got faster lenses, better sensitized materials, just basically improving features.
And at what point did camera technology start to resemble the ones that we use today, or at least the analog cameras we use today?
A lot of this really just does go to George Eastman and the concept of initially he created gelatin dry plates, something you could use in the field, bring it home to your darkroom and then process them. So it was that was the beginning of it. He realized that dry plates was not going to be the end all. So he started working on a flexible film base. Originally, he went to a paper support system with a roll holder. These were for fairly good sized view cameras. Most images were the same size as what was produced in the camera. So for a bigger image, you needed a bigger camera. So he produced his roll film. It's called Eastman's American Film. And it was with a holder that would be attached to the back of a fairly good sized view camera. It's intended really for professional photographers, except he ran into one hitch. The professional photographers didn't like the stuff. So instead of giving up, he came up with an idea of producing it for a much smaller handheld camera for the newly emerging amateur market. So this was introduced in 1888 called the Kodak. He wanted a name that would represent the product. And to trademark it, it had to be a non-dictionary word, so he had to make the word up. But the gist of it was an easy-to-use camera. And basically, you lifted up a string to cock the shutter, you pointed at something, you pushed the button. The shutter speed was about a 25th or so of a second. The film speed rating in today's ISO numbers would be somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 3. It's not very fast. And he had this insight as to why the professional photographers didn't like it. And it had to do with the fact that they did not like processing it. It was a little fussy to them. It was different from what they were used to doing.
Okay.
They decided, okay, if the professionals don't do it, we'll actually provide the photo finishing service. So the camera was sold with this advertising slogan that was written by George Eastman called,
"You press the button, we do the rest.
And it made it very simple. So it came with a box.
It was a sort of box with a lens at the front of it, and the film was in it.
You'd shoot your 100 pictures, you'd ship it back, they'd process it and send it back to you reloaded.
And ta-da, magic, photos come back.
So really from that time on, it's a matter of improving your picture-taking potential and also making the price more reasonable. The Kodak was fairly expensive at its time. It cost $25 to buy the camera loaded with film and another $10 to process it and reload it.
Remember how I used to run around with a brownie, taking pictures of trees and clouds?
He used to take some of me, too.
Yeah, he's lucky. Not like me.
In 1900, they come up with the brownie camera, which was a camera that was originally intended for children. It sold for $1. The roll of film cost 15 cents for 6 pictures, not 100, and processing was 45 cents. So basically, he took what used to be really, really complicated and expensive, and he made it simple and affordable.
And since there is no sort of culture photography at that time, a lot of the advertising is really fascinating, the early 20th century advertisements for Kodak products, because what they're doing also is telling you what you should do with this camera, right? So you're not going to sort of set up this box camera, like this disposable sort of brownie camera on a tripod and do oil portrait style sittings with your family. You could take it outside. And then they would like do these advertising illustrations of like a family at a beach and a mom holding the camera while the kids and the dad get in the center of it. It's like, you could do this with the camera, right? So the technology comes, and then from the technology, the companies that are trying to sell this new technology to consumers are coaching the consumers about how to do this. So sort of family album style, I'm on vacation, here is somebody's birthday, little Johnny is graduating, so-and-so got married. Those types of photos now are being taken in what the scholar Edward Chalfin calls home mode photography, right? Which is, it develops in the 20th century where you're like, oh, I'm going to document my own family life in some charming and adorable locations. It's going to be casual. It's going to be fun. We take pictures when relatives get together. We take pictures in front of the Christmas tree.
And really from the Brownie on, 1900, all we've been doing is increasing your picture-taking opportunities, if you would, by, again, producing easier cameras to use and also add color film in the 30s later.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a camera like mine. I knew he'd get one as soon as he saw the one I had, the copycat. Yep, the instruction sheet is just like mine. It tells you exactly how to use your camera. I'm telling you, Joe, you better read it. Don't be a schmo, Joe. What's that? Oh, it's not focused correctly. It must be a picture of Mabel and Rover. I only know it because I saw him shoot it. Now let's leave Joe and his troubles for a minute. See if we can find the correct way to focus.
You're listening to Spark from your friends at CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, and today another in our special series, The Butterfly Effect, about the surprising impacts of seemingly small technical innovations. This time we're looking at the camera and the impact photography has had on how we see ourselves and the world around us. So far, Todd Gustafson has been our historical guide, charting the evolution of photography from its pinhole precursor to the advent of color film. In a few minutes, Todd will bring us into the camera's digital age. We've also been hearing from Amy Morrison about photography in the Victorian era and the evolution of personal photo taking. A little later on, she'll tell us how portraiture evolved into the ubiquitous selfie. But first, a trip to the New York City art scene of the 1970s and 80s.
I'm Marvin Heiferman, and I'm a curator and writer and, I guess, a photographer. I started out working as an art gallerist and started representing artists and then started doing museum shows that were about artists who were using photographic images from the media. It was kind of the time of appropriation. People like Cindy Sherman, Richard Prince, who were peers and friends, and also did other projects using photography to raise money for social causes, for AIDS research, and started to become more interested in how photography could reflect or change our everyday life. That made my projects less art gallery, art museum oriented, and had a broader reach and started to reach interesting audiences.
So for your book, Photography Changes Everything, you spoke to people from many different fields and you asked them, how did photography change your discipline? So what came out of those conversations?
That was extraordinary. I had been asked by the Smithsonian to help them figure out what to do with their 15 million pictures. And starting to look at them in 19 different museums that all represented different interests, I kind of understood that photography functioned very differently in different environments. Even people who had never thought about photography as central to their work realized that it was.
Yeah. Were there answers that particularly surprised you or stuck with you?
All kinds of ones about history. You know, for example, I talked to a World War II historian who talked about how before the Normandy invasion, the Allies flew surveillance planes over the ocean to find out where German mines were buried underneath, and it changed the whole battle plan.
Wow.
Or I talked to the curator of spiders at the Smithsonian who had set up a worldwide group of people to scan and share images of spiders so they could create an atlas that represented them perfectly and in 3D when none existed before. So, you know, it was stuff like that versus, oh, I don't know, six-year-olds taking photographs or what was happening in terms of social media when I did this project, which was about 2012.
I mean, photography can certainly be art, but you've also said, and this is a quote, the photographs that don't get framed, those that deliver the news, sell clothes, get you a date, cause parking tickets to be written and save lives, that those can also be representative of social and cultural issues. Can you tell me about that?
I got to be fascinated with it because I was involved in the 1970s with people trying to get people used to the idea that photography is art, might be art, could be art, was art. And that was a limited audience of people. And that when you start to look about the use of images, the impact of images, our reliance on imagery every day, that created a different dialogue and suggested that visual literacy that people don't really think about or talk about much is a very big issue that we all kind of engage in one way or the other, but should be thinking about a lot more and talking about a lot more and teaching a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a bit more about that idea of like this sort of visual language being with us all the time that we don't really reflect on very much?
We don't think about it. When I did Photography Changes Everything, one of the people I reached out to was an MIT researcher who was interested in perception. And she was doing research on what's called the gist of a scene. And what was found out was that if you show somebody even an out-of-focus photograph of a kitchen or a street scene, they can recognize, they can extract the subject matter in a hundredth of a second. It was a crazy number.
Wow.
And so there's things to be learned about photographs when you see them very quickly, and there's things to be learned from photographs when you spend more time with them. And the kind of attention and time that we spend with images depends upon how and where we encounter them. And I wanted people to be more aware of that and more mindful of how much there is to learn in an image and how much we take for granted about them. But if you start asking questions about how they were made, who they were made by, what they were made for, how their forms change over time, people think very differently about it. And you kind of see it now, you know, with people making selfies and images, everybody's a photographer now. People think about making pictures in ways that they never did before smartphones were introduced.
Company said technological innovations have changed the way Canadians take and share photographs, with fewer of us using retail photo outlets.
I take a lot of pictures, but I do download on my computer.
Digital cameras crushed the businesses of companies like Kodak and Polaroid.
The need for the camera kind of went the way of the dinosaur.
How does a modern digital camera work, just in general terms? What processes are happening after I click the shutter button?
Well, in some ways, if you think of the way a film camera works, that part of it is the same, and you're still putting it onto some sort of recording device. The difference is, instead of having a silver-based film inside that you process, you're actually looking at a charge-coupled device, a CCD or CMOS device, one or the other, and basically black and white. To get color, they actually add a color array pattern in front of the sensor. So when Steve Sasson, the Kodak engineer who was just out of college, was given the assignment to investigate the imaging potential of the charge-coupled device, he started out with a 100 by 100 pixel sensor, which is pretty small, and made images with it in a handheld camera in 1975. Now, wow. They were not very good, but he made images.
But still, 1975, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, the company didn't really release the fact that they had done this until about 2001. You know, obviously, they started developing things that would improve. I mean, he used sort of a convoluted version of Moore's Law when he was asked the question, when is this going to be a consumer product? And he just figured, well, you're going to need at least a million pixels, and he had 100. So he just figured it's going to take about 18 years. And that's pretty close to what happened.
It's new. It's now. It's Flash Cube. Flash Cube. Flash Cube. It's this way, man. Drop in a film. Get yourself a Flash Cube. Pop it on. Take one. Take two. Take three. Take four flash pictures without changing bulbs. In color, of course. Newest Instamatic camera outfit.
And so then by the time we have cell phone cameras, you know, of a reasonable quality and those sort of front-facing cameras, did we again need to have that education in how to use the technology?
Or absolutely.
Yeah, really?
Absolutely, yeah. So cameras on phones originally were just on the back of the phone, right? And so people would sometimes like do the thing where they like try to turn it around and take a selfie of themselves, and it would turn out kind of ridiculous because you can't see what you're doing. You also can't really see the button, right? And the first controversy around that was, since you have this phone everywhere and a lot of people have their phones up a lot of the time, it was difficult to tell when people were taking pictures, right? So it was easy to quite surreptitiously take pictures where it had been nearly impossible to take surreptitious photos before so easily. There are a lot of ways that people have disguised taking photographs in the past, but like just to have your phone out in front of you does not cue to anybody, oh, they're taking a picture.
Right.
So there was like bans about, oh, now you can't take a photo inside a locker room. At the hospital, they'll say like, oh, you can, you know, if you're going to take a photo of your loved one here, like be attentive to who else is in the frame, you know, to protect people's privacy, because now cameras are everywhere. I mean, I don't really think there was a genre of photography that could be, look at my cat trying to attack my underwear from between my feet while I sit on the toilet, right? Which is right. Like, you're laughing because you've seen that photo. Like we've all
I may have taken that photo.
I may have taken that photo too. This is radio. We don't have to share, right? But the camera's there so easily now, and it's always right there in our hands that the occasions in which we are able to take photographs have just expanded so rapidly that we've had to sort of think a little bit more carefully once we see these images coming out. Is that appropriate? Do I want to share that?
So there's both the temptation to look at pictures quickly and judge them quickly. But I think we know more about them just because we look at so many of them. You know, I'm fascinated by Instagram, where I scroll through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures every night really fast. And, you know, many, many people do. And I think, again, photography operates on a lot of levels. So it depends on what you're looking at and what you're looking for. And also about how more and more about how you choose to represent yourself for the world, which is a really interesting change in the last couple of decades. It's once you start to think about it, you realize how big the impact of cameras and the medium are and how underexamined they are.
So, I mean, artists have long done self-portraits, but what does it mean for self-portraiture now that selfies are pretty much ubiquitous?
Yeah, self-portraiture for artists, and I've been working on this book, I've been going to a lot of art galleries when I happen to be traveling for work. And everywhere I go, I see artists, you know, painting in oils themselves or, you know, doing photography of themselves. And usually what we understand to be self-portraits is a little bit different from selfies. Selfies is like, here's me right now giving you a message. It's communicating outward. But often a self-portrait is almost like psychoanalytic investigation of the self. That we try to depict ourselves in self-portraits where the message that we're conveying is about who we are in some fundamental and perhaps unknowable way, rather than here I am in the cheese aisle. Did you want Emmental? Yeah. Right? Or Gouda? Yeah. I can't remember. You know, you've got your hands up looking confused in the cheese aisle in your selfie. Like it's not really about that, or it's not about look at my outfit. A self-portrait might be not just putting an outfit on, but then arranging every article of clothing that you own behind you to make some sort of statement about how outfit of the day is actually an awful lot of labor and you're quite obsessed with it, right? So so normally a self-portrait tells a story that's somewhat bigger than here I am and who I am is a sort of act of inquiry, not just representation there.
This is Spark from CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. This is The Butterfly Effect, Spark's special series on the surprising scope and range of seemingly small technological innovations. This time, the impact of the camera. So far, we've been hearing about the cultural impact of photography with academic and internet bon vivant Amy Morrison and curator, writer, and photographer Marvin Heiferman. We've also been getting the historical lay of the land with Todd Gustafson. He's a technology curator at the George Eastman Museum in Rochester, New York. He's responsible for one of the world's largest collections of photographic and cinematic equipment.
A few years ago, we were lucky enough to succeed in bidding on original rolls of Kodak film from 1888 and 89.
Wow.
So some of the things are quite novel and some of them are rare and unusual. We have the last digital camera that was made in Rochester currently on display.
Oh, wow.
And on the opposite end of the spectrum, we also have the earliest surviving or known surviving DSLR, which was built in about 1987. So we have both of those here. Some of these things are really unusual just because they're just not commonly seen.
So in your role, you get to collaborate and connect with some of the most influential people in the industry, like the Kodak engineer Steven Sasson. Do you get a sense of how these industry leaders feel about the world of cameras that we're in now, where we're all documenting everything all the time?
It's always interesting talking with Steve and some of the other guys. Again, their point of view is, you know, the stuff that they were pushing and kind of being ignored many, many, many years ago has all come into fruition. And where this is going is probably AI related. So instead of having to have bigger and bigger objects to make high quality images, the cameras are actually getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, I've said for years, how big is the sensor that's on your eye? I mean, your retina is a very small device. And it's got a pretty good, hopefully good processor attached to it. So one would think you don't need to have a huge sensor to create high quality images.
We've been looking on this week's show at sort of world-changing technologies. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts on what the world would have been like if the camera had never been invented.
See, I think it's inevitable that it would have been invented. So there is that. I mean, people were trying to work on these things for many, many years. But certainly as far as sharing any kind of images, I mean, one of the other things that I think of is that we have in the collection is we have one of the Lunar Orbiter camera payload satellites that was built by Kodak for NASA to map the surface of the moon. And basically, they built a device that would go to the moon, photograph film, process it, scan it, send it back.
Wow.
So in a way, for instance, if we didn't have cameras, we wouldn't have made it to the moon because we would not have known where to land, because that's the whole project was about, was to map the moon looking for a nice, smooth, rock-free place to land. Hmm. How does one look at daily events, news without images? I mean, if you go back to pre-photography, something would happen and people would write about it and maybe there'd be a drawing about it that showed up about 3 or 4 months later. Now, if something happens and you don't have immediate imagery of it, it's like it never happened.
Todd Gustafson is a technology curator at the George Eastman Museum in Rochester, New York.
The camera lens is a mechanical eye, seeing everything and recording everything. It captures actions that will never again be repeated. Used with a microscope, it records the strange activities of tiny organisms. With the X-ray, it reveals the structure or function of hidden things. Photography, in one form or another, exerts a great influence on our daily lives. Photography as a hobby can lead to photography as a career, and often does. But professional work calls for a lot more than just snapping pictures here and there.
I'm Nora Young, and this is The Butterfly Effect here on Spark. Today we're talking about the surprising range and long reach of the camera and the photographic image. Now more with Amy Morrison, Associate Professor of English at the University of Waterloo, and Marvin Heiferman, a longtime curator and writer. He also runs a social media project called Why We Look, where he tracks news and stories about imaging and visual culture. We can document our own daily lives with photography, and that's within our control, but there's also this documentation that's happening all the time outside of our control. So how has the evolution of photography changed surveillance practices?
It's been a huge influence. You know, every day I put up stories on Twitter and Facebook kind of tracking visual culture issues like these. And it just goes on and on. You know, I was reading, for example, the other day, the Chinese government has blocked people uploading images about poverty, right, to social media. I was looking at another article that in which people were trying to figure out, they were talking to first responders, EMTs, police, whatever, and people who collect evidence in mass shooting crime scenes, which are so prevalent in America, and where there's huge arguments about whether we should be looking at these or not. And the article was what it's like to be looking at these things, making decisions about these pictures and who gets to see them and who does it, and what it's like to go home at the end of the day having seen them.
Yeah.
So, and surveillance, you know, everything from license plate readers where the police are tracking you to the surveillance monitor that my landlord just put up right on top of my front door at my apartment, you know. So it's everywhere. So definitely it's surveillance culture.
Yeah. So there's that double-edged sense, it sounds like you're saying, between on the one hand, there's the unwanted surveillance of us, but then there's also
the blocking of our ability to share images where it might be helpful in some cases.
Yes, yes, yeah. And that's an interesting thing in terms of platforms for posting pictures. You know, you look at Instagram and Facebook and these arguments like, you know, about what levels of nudity are allowed. Do we know whether male nipples are okay, but female nipples aren't, or are breastfeeding pictures allowed, or, you know, should people be photographing the police at demonstrations, or what's happening at the borders? There are endless issues around this and examples of how we're always being watched and watching each other and watching others.
Well, technologies like Clearview have really led us into mass surveillance. They scrape images off the internet. So anything you'd put up on Facebook, if your Facebook is not set completely to private back in the day, up come your pictures from Flickr, from Google Images, from various storage sites where they give you X number of gigabytes free and you don't pay for it, means that something is being done with your data there. And so these mass surveillance tools for facial recognition are largely built out of images that people have posted of themselves in online spaces, right? Or that others have posted. Any photo that exists out there on the internet has probably been scraped up. Many times it's able to be identified to exactly who you are individually. These tools can recognize that this is a face. And then from that recognition that this is a human face, very often they can identify which human is actually in the image. And that has profound privacy implications.
What do you think it means when we can no longer actually believe what we're looking at?
I don't think we ever should have believed what we were looking at. So this is probably a useful development. So I teach every year a version of a course I call Rhetoric of the Selfie and interrogate my students as to the truth value of photography. And they do all enter sort of thinking like a photo is for real. So there used to be this thing on the internet we would call like pics or get the F out, mm-hmm. pics or it didn't happen, right? There is this sort of like documentary and evidentiary value of having a photograph of something. But now photographs can be faked, like entirely, like the Pope wearing a puffer jacket, famously. Yeah, that image was marked as satire too. And nevertheless, like it made the rounds as if it was real. So since everything can be faked, we do well to attend a little bit more closely to understanding how images like that get made, how all images get made. It's a choice of composition, of framing, of angle, of lighting, of editing, right? It is always an editorial statement. A photo is always an editorial statement. It is not just a self-evident thing. Even trail cams with adorable bears scratching their backs on trees, right? The trail cam is set up there on purpose, yeah. And they're giving us the highlight reel from that, right? It's been edited to come to us. And so there is a way in which something happened in this space that was captured by a photo, but the photo is not the whole story. The photo is a perspective on a story.
So the last time we talked to you about selfies, editors for the Oxford Dictionary suggest named selfie the word of the year for 2013. So what's the arc of their popularity look like over the last decade?
As a practice, it has become a lot more normalized, which is to say it's a lot less exciting in many ways, right? So because everybody does it, your mom does it, right? Your kids do it, your friends at work do it, guys on the subway do it. Everybody's taking selfies all the time. So the practice is ubiquitous and therefore kind of less interesting and edgy. And selfies have also become more formalized. There's ways that we know how to take them now. They have the same sort of rules that other types of photography have. And they've also become commercialized. So who could have predicted the whole influencer economy? But here we are.
Can you talk a little bit more about that idea of how it's become sort of formalized and what the kind of norms of selfies have grown into be?
Yeah, selfies started off as this kind of trick we could play on cameras, right? Where we got to fix our lighting and we got to choose filters and we could do special effects that used to only be the purview of professional photographers or the Justin's School photographers that would come and take remarkably unflattering portraits for graduation, right? And I think since that time, we've all learned ways to pose that make us feel that we're represented the way we want to be seen. We've learned a lot more about photo editing. Mm-hmm. I would say there's a lot less tolerance for kind of lousy snapshots now, right?
Right.
The kind that used to sort of pervade kitchen fridges everywhere, vacation shots where people are like in the dead center of a giant field and there's like a bunch of like garbage at the front that nobody edited out and maybe a dog pooping in the background. So I think visual literacy wise, we've all come to expect a lot more at the same time as we've all become mostly a lot more capable. So the whole thing has been professionalized, I think.
One of your ongoing projects is actually a book on selfies. Can you tell me about that?
People think that because you have a camera that's on both sides of your phone and you can just snap a picture of anything, that there's no skill or intention involved, right? So selfies are often some combination of we think people are trying too hard, but also that they have no talent, right? So my book is kind of in that in-between space saying like, well, what, it can't be both, right? It can't be completely thoughtless and anybody can do it and it's not worth doing because there's no skill involved. And you can't then on the other hand say everybody's trying super hard with this and they've got their lighting rigs and they're working their angles and they're like changing their outfits and they're going to these locations, right? So what if selfies are intentional and what if they produce social work for people? They accomplish goals that people want to accomplish in life by photographic means. That's what I'm looking at.
I'm Nora Young, and this is The Butterfly Effect here on Spark, all about the surprising places photography has taken us since the first permanent image was captured nearly 200 years ago. Right now, my guests are Amy Morrison, an associate professor at the University of Waterloo, and curator, writer, and photographer Marvin Heiferman. We tend to think of photography as documenting, but when photography is based on the very act of framing, can it ever really capture reality or be the truth, capital T?
Photographs can be the truth in the same way that writing can be the truth, in the same way that a musical composition or a painting can be the truth, and that it captures one person's understanding or experience of a given scene, more or less processed. So sometimes we write things down in the moment. Sometimes it's just a scrawl of what is happening, as in a diary maybe, but sometimes when we write essays about things, we're looking back, we're being more intentional about how we're capturing something. And photography works like that too, is that it's always just one person's perspective on a moment. And in fact, cameras don't even really capture reality. Something I learned recently about camera lenses is they distort. Just by nature of it, right? It's not a human eyeball. It distorts, and it distorts particularly around the edges, right? And so there is a zone of perfect focus or almost perfect focus that a lens will get where there's the least amount of like bending of lines, a kind of a slight curvature that appears, or a foreshortening effect that exaggerates depth. And that's called the zone of least confusion. That area of the frame, which I just love, right? Because like we tend to think of photography as just straightforward reality, but like people who design lenses are like, look, this part, this tiny fraction, this like 10% at the center of the image is the zone of least confusion, right? I was like, wow, that's great. I would like to stay in the zone of least confusion.
That's what I'm looking for my whole life, the zone of least confusion.
That's not where I live, right? So there are a lot of ways in which when you take an image now with your iPhone, the reason it looks better with your like iPhone 13 Pro than it did with your iPhone 3G is because of the processing that's happening inside the camera. So it's capturing the same reality that you might have caught with your 3G phone. It's just the algorithms inside the machine that map the pixels that are able to be like, oh, that's a tree. It shouldn't be that dark. Or this sky is much brighter than the foreground. So we're going to try to manage that out. So there's a lot of algorithmic processing of the data points captured when your lens opens, right? And the image now is registered as pulses of light on a sensitive electromagnetic field. And then that gets processed. So with a film camera, when you open the shutter, the light comes in and it hits a chemically treated photosensitive surface. It's literally like burning an image from real life just by the light hitting these chemicals. But electronic cameras don't work like that. Digital cameras don't work like that. It's basically a sensor. It's a digital sensor in the same way that your digital scale is a digital sensor, right? It is receiving input and then translating that input into a type of output that we can understand. So your photos, you get better and better at photography with every new phone that you get, not necessarily because your skill is improving, but because the algorithms that auto-correct the distortions between what we see and what the camera perceives are different. So we might say that today's photos are much more realistic and true to life, but paradoxically, that is because they are the most algorithmically processed.
With in-app filters and photo editing apps like Facetune, it's never been easier to manipulate how we look in a photo or video. Do you think the expectation that we'll look the same in photos as we do in real life is becoming obsolete?
I think it's difficult. I think that's really difficult, right? So, you know, in the last 10 years or so, there's, you know, has been news reports about people don't understand the distortion that their front-facing camera produces, and they go for surgery because they think their noses look really weird, right? Their noses look weird because of the distortion produced by the camera. So people are getting a sort of poor idea of what they actually look like relative to others. I mean, there's that, you know, there was the makeup trend that we call the Instagram face. So you could kind of look in real life like you had been face-tuned, because people got so used to engaging with other people through these visual media that human beings in the flesh look weirdly fleshy and natural, and they had pores and shiny foreheads, right? So there was a way in which the fakeness of what we looked at online, on the one hand, tried to make us make it look more real, but on the other hand, made us try to look a little bit more fake in our real life interactions with people so that we would match that digital image as a sort of instance of Baudrillard's simulacrum there, right? So the Instagram face is a copy of something that there's no original for because it only exists on a screen, right? So you're trying to turn yourself into a representation of yourself from a representation.
Do you think that that's happening in other spheres of our self-perception beyond that Instagram face, that what we view as reality is reality as it's shaped in all of those online images, which then feeds back into our IRL experience?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's always been this thing of like, you know, you don't want to get the home design magazines because like you look up from House Beautiful and you're like, oh God, I live in apartment crappy. Like now the thing is people are buying books, I guess. They're getting designers to curate the bookshelves behind them for their Zoom calls because they don't want to show their real books to people because people will make fun of them and they want to convey a certain vibe, right? So now people are purchasing books, sometimes fake books, just the spines of books, in order to convey a message that exceeds, I have read this book. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a little bit, the fake meets the real becomes more real than the real was. And image culture is to blame or thank for that.
It's a very big, big issue. It photography, for all of its claims to objectivity, has always been something that can be manipulated. So there was always photo retouching going back to the early 19th century. And when Photoshop and programs like that started to be introduced 40 years ago, or I guess it was, or give or take, you know, that started raising issues about truth and what's, you know, how do we know what's true anymore in photographs? And artificial intelligence, as it is in many fields, is just kind of escalating these kind of articles. Like, what's real? What's misinformation? What's disinformation? What, you know, what can we trust? And so you get a medium that was, on the one hand, talking about contradictions, which is what makes photography really interesting. It was supposed to be objective, but it never was. And so you've got to be mindful about all of this now. And going back to the visual literacy issue that we mentioned earlier, it's good to get people aware of these kind of possibilities for taking images, transforming images, using them, abusing them, so they're better able to understand, enjoy, or use, or turn their heads away from what they're looking at.
Yeah. You know, two recent exhibits I saw, one by the German photographic artist Wolfgang Tillmans and the other about Leonard Cohen, which had a lot of photographs in it, had me thinking that we often do think about, you know, culturally, we think about photos as documentary, but the line between what's objective and what's self-creation in photography is a lot more slippery than that.
Yeah. And I think that whenever anyone takes a picture, or they're making decisions, what's going to be in the picture, what's not going to be in the picture. And even camera vision is making those kind of, you know, license plate cameras or surveillance cameras is making those kind of decisions too. So it's the field is changing really, really quickly in terms of what we can see, what we should see, what we shouldn't see, what we want to see. And photography remains at the center of it because at the base of it, it's one of the ways it functions is as data, and as data becomes more and more valuable, so do photographs.
Yeah. Marvin, you've worked in the art photography world for a long time, but you've only recently adopted the title of photographer for yourself. So how's your perspective changed now that you're on the other side of the lens, so to speak?
It happened only because of a life-changing circumstance. I was, in fact, working on a book about Instagram. I wanted to write about a book about how Instagram shaped culture and was reshaping our lives and our engagement with photography. And when the pandemic hit, my husband, Maurice Berger, and I went to our house outside of New York City thinking we'd be safer, and we weren't. And 5 days after the pandemic started, he died of COVID-related illness.
Oh my God.
And I didn't know how to deal with it, and words were failing me. And 3 days after Maurice died, I went out to take a walk down the road with that we lived on, and passed a house, a little tiny house that had an American flag on a pole, on a tree, and the flag was wrapped around the pole. I thought, that's really messed up. I'm feeling messed up. That matches what I feel. I took a picture of it. And then I started realizing that I was already taking a picture every day on Instagram and posting it. So I started making pictures about what I was feeling, thinking, and doing. And all of a sudden, it became this chronicle of grief and the pandemic and my experience. And you know, people, I've been on Instagram since 2014, and people like my pictures. I've worked with lots and lots and lots of amazing picture makers in my life. So I know how to make a good picture. But this changed how I used photography personally. And it became a fulcrum for a community that grew and grew and grew to talk about grief, the pandemic, you know, what was going on. So yeah, it's interesting to be a photographer now.
And did it help you deal with your grief in a way that you wouldn't have been able to if you weren't taking the pictures?
Yes.
Yeah.
Knowing that I would make a picture every day and put it up at 5 o'clock gave me something to do every day when you couldn't see people, there was nothing to do, you couldn't go out, you know. So that became a structure for it. And what soon started happening, and this is the part that really surprised me and is certainly about photography's reach, is that people started finding these pictures somehow. And then people started writing to me. I mean, they started, you know, commenting on the pictures, but then I started getting DMs from people who were starting to share their experience during the pandemic or their experiences in terms of loss of spouses, of children, of all kinds of stuff. And that kind of harked back to what I mentioned a little bit earlier about how photography can be used to address all sorts of issues and connect people. And that community that grew around my Instagram project, which is also called Why We Look, that's what's gotten me through the last 3 years. And I learned a lot through that. And I'm amazed that the platform, that social media makes something like that possible, and that images make it possible, that people looked at images and understood intuitively how I was feeling and connected to it.
Yeah.
With me saying things about it or not, but it registered. And I thought, well, this is intense and interesting and something I had never encountered before.
Amy, how much of an impact do you think the cameras had on how we view ourselves, both online and in the physical world?
Oh, an unbelievable, unbelievable impact. I mean, I think we can probably blame cameras for fast fashion at this point. These services where you can buy an entire outfit for $13 and you're going to wear it once and then throw it away because it looks cute in the photo, right? Even though it can't be washed. And also you wouldn't want to spend good money on good clothes because you can't rewear a dress in your Instagram, right? So there's this culture of display of the self that has really developed that holds people to sort of Hollywood standards. So they're just borrowing dresses. They're not, you know, going to Shein and buying like a $13 dress and then throwing it in the garbage after, right? They're giving these clothes back, these very expensive clothes. So there's a way in which we are always now conscious that we are being looked at. I mean, many women already had that idea, right? That's the male goes of this idea that no matter where you go in public, you have to be attentive to what you look like because you know people are assessing you according to beauty standards. And now pretty much everyone feels that way. Everyone feels like They could be starring in someone's viral video by accident. Somebody could be taking a photo of them right now. They may be in the view of a surveillance camera in an elevator. So they don't want to like dig that wedgie out of their butt because they don't want it to make a highlight reel in some security company footage. Like, we're always now sensitive to the fact that we're not quite alone. We might always be being photographed, and we're always trying to look our best, which is sometimes maybe incompatible with being our best or feeling our best.
Amy Morrison is an associate professor of English at the University of Waterloo. Marvin Heiferman is a curator, photographer, and the author of Photography Changes Everything. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Michelle Parisi, Samarui Yohannes, McKenna Hadley-Burke, Matt Muse, and me, Nora Young. And by Todd Gustafson, Amy Morrison, and Marvin Heiferman. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on social media, SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.